welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Everyday Heroes, we look at the lesser-known people who have shaped history. And first, the Yemeni war has created the world's largest humanitarian disaster. Over 80% of the population is at risk, with particular vulnerabilities to children. And the COVID pandemic has worsened conditions. What are the causes of the war? Why is it not ending? And how can it be resolved? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Since 2014, when the Houthi faction seized this capital city of Sana'a and compelled President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi to flee to the southern city of Aden, Yemen has been plunged into an ongoing civil war. It has become the most salient battleground for the ongoing rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And it's been described as the world's worst humanitarian disaster by the United Nations. And the war continues to rage on. On today's show, we will explore the causes of the war, the impact of foreign intervention, and a pathway to a resolution. Our guests are Hamad Sali, who is the Associate Dean of International Education and Senior International Officer and Professor of Political Science at California State University Dominguez Hills. He is a commentator for Arabic media. And Charles Schmitz, who is the professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland. He is an affiliated scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. He's the author of the publications Negotiating Yemeni Peace, Deep Divisions and Hard Realities, No Winners in Yemen, and the Historical Dictionary of Yemen. Thank you both for joining us. Charles Schmitz, I'll start with you. Could you give us a description of where the war stands now and some of the reasons why this war continues, you know, persists and seems to not have much of a resolution?
Well, first, thank you for having me. So the war's heated up. You know, Biden, of course, pledged to end the war in Yemen, to end U.S. support for the Saudi effort in Yemen. And of course, those were campaign pledges that didn't have a whole lot of details in them. And since Biden's election, the war has heated up. And the big front that heated up was a Houthi push towards Marib, which is the eastern province in Yemen. It's the last sort of stronghold of the Hadi regime in the north, in the former north of Yemen. It is strategic for a number of reasons, one of which is that Yemen does not have a lot of oil and gas, but what remains of it is out there. I think the Houthi sensing that the international environment was changing and there was the possibility of actually some negotiations, they pushed forward to try and create facts on the ground. They ran into a lot of resistance. And what's interesting here is that the Yemeni forces in Marib, tribal forces and the Yemeni military, and a lot of southern forces that have come to reinforce them as well, they've been holding pretty well. It's been a serious onslaught. They've been holding well. The Saudis have been using their air power to try and hold the Houthi off. And this, of course, is with the U.S. The U.S. is not objecting to this. The U.S. had said they didn't want the Saudis to be bombing in Yemen. But, you know, the nature of this part of the conflict here, the Houthis are certainly pushing the issue. And so, you know, the Saudis are, and their support is critical for the defense of Marib. The government forces, the Hadi side has, there's many aligned forces within Hadi. But as a result of the Houthi push on Marib, I should say that the Houthi have also attacked Saudi Arabia many times. They've been really pushing Saudi Arabia. They seem to be trying their best possible to provoke the Saudis. To show the Saudis that they can attack with impunity. I think as well, you know, as a negotiating card is to say that you're not going to be able to push us over. You know, we don't want negotiations that bad. We're in a pretty good position here and you're in a difficult situation. Then on the ground on other fronts outside of Marib, in Taiz and in the north in Hadja, there have been advances by critical and important advances for the first time by the anti-Houthi forces. and particularly in Taiz, which is an area that the Houthi have blockaded. It's a main city in what we call Lower Yemen. It's still in North Yemen, but it's called Lower Yemen. And it's not seen as a Houthi stronghold, but they've had a blockade on the city for the course of the war so far. And the Hadi side is close to breaking that, which would be a significant shift in the war. It would be a good development for the city of Taiz. And the other development is in the south, where you have some forces that are that have fought Hadi, the Southern Transitional Council, people who are backed by the Emirates and pushing for Southern independence. They've said some interesting things. They negotiated in Riyadh peace with the Hadi forces, and there actually is a combined government in Aden right now, but they retain military control of the city. And they have said that if Marib falls, they will negotiate with the Houthi, which was that's a bold stance. I mean, basically, they were saying that, you know, we'll let the Houthi take the north and we'll take the south. The Houthi responded by saying that we will not negotiate with mercenaries. We will deal directly with the foreign powers that are backing the mercenaries in Yemen, who are Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. So the Houthis are claiming control of all of Yemen, and they don't seem willing to negotiate with anybody at this point. So that's sort of the roundup, a heated up front with all sides kind of trying to create facts on the ground before some sort of anticipated negotiations.
So now you've referenced a number of different factions within the Yemeni war, so that everybody, you know, is clear on this. You've got the Hadi government, that is the officially recognized government, recognized by the United Nations and UN resolutions have identified this, and they have the backing of Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia's allies. You mentioned the Emirates, who are linked with Saudi Arabia. The Houthis, who as a resistance, or as a rebel force, had seized control of the capital, and their major backer is Iran, from my understanding. And the challenge here is that the Houthis control the capital city, which is in the former North Yemen. The country was unified. We'll get into that in a moment, as to how much of that is part of the conflict. And then ultimately, the United States position has traditionally been supportive of the Saudis and opposition to the Houthis. So with that in mind, Hamoud Salih, what role have international actors played at either complicating or prolonging this conflict? Or for many places, if the foreign actors just got out of Yemen, the Yemenis could figure out a way to a peace agreement. Is that a fair assessment?
It's a fair assessment. But I think we should take it a little bit further and going back deep, not really in history, but the role of what the International Monetary Fund did back in 2000, I believe, in 2000s, maybe. I think it's 2013 or so. I'm sorry, before 2011, this is around 2010, where it provided a law, a foreign loan to Yemen on condition, like what the IMF does. You know, there are some reforms we want you to do. And as a consequence, that trickled down into lifting the subsidized items, fuel in particular, and it created sort of a conditions for what later became the Arab Spring, or however we define that, in 2011. So the role of international organization, IMF in this particular, can be looked at from the perspective that the economic problems that Yemen was facing at the time sort of contributed to the current crisis. The second thing, when you look at how it, back around to November or October 2011, when the Security Council sort of came in and endorsed at the time the plan that would, for example, remove Saleh from power, the president, with condition that it's very hard to read it because the UN, according to the UN envoy, Alban Omar, did not endorse what the GCC was pushing, that Saleh at the time was in Saudi Arabia, Riyadh, was asking for full immunity, but according to the UN envoy, Jamal Ben Omar at the time, he believed that will be against international law. So instead, what the United Nations Security Council pushed is for reconciliation, or what we call the Gulf Initiative. That another intervention in the foreign intervention, however we understood it, but bear in mind, Yemen is in the Gulf region, and yet it is not a member of the GCC. Consequently, one clearly see that such attempt is a foreign intervention. So you have the role of the coalition led by the Saudis in Yemen is a major force. And what that force did is to protect the regions, and particularly Saudi Arabia's interest, the United States along with that. And there they were also not very supportive for a solution that will end, also would contribute to the resolution. Case in point, they launched back, I think, a national dialogue that lasts for about 9 months around 2013. And one of the failure of that national dialogue is its agreement on the first of creating what you call a national united Yemen, while leaving the question of how this federation will function, particularly how many regions will be the sort of structured, the geography of this federation, and the number of how many states or whatever regions you are going to have. Subsequent to that, the two major parties at the time agreed to designate six regions and assign the Houthis to the mountainous areas with no access to waters or sea. So that's a second variable that would be when the UN today supports or supported at the time the national dialogue, that also should be a function in. The third problem, I think, with foreign intervention, beside what it brought, its emphasis, particularly the United States, on the threat of Al-Qaeda, the threat of terrorism, without looking, having a comprehensive strategy or an exit strategy, is the way it approached the political solutions. It is advocating for a political solution, which is the same thing we've seen in Libya, and sort of postponing or taking a step-by-step resolution of the military conflict by believing that if you take one area, control under one city, you can move to the other city. In other words, this strategic incremental approach in resolving the military problem is a serious business. The whole point from all of this is that foreign intervention in Yemen has exacerbated the crisis and contributed to its continuance without, because of the mere fact that it did not, or it has yet to address the fundamental root causes of the Yemeni crisis. And returning back to the economic issue that I started with, is one area perhaps we should be, the international organization should be focused.
Now, Charles Schmitz, Yemen is one of these conflicts that certainly has, you know, these local conditions that at least in part seems to date back to the unification of the country and questions of identity. I know these ethnic questions are sometimes, you know, even kind of described as tribal or clannish kinds of conflicts that seem to date back to the fact Yemen during the Cold War was divided and then unified at the end of the Cold War. I've always sort of wrestled with this question. Is this a country that should seek to divide, or is there a way to bridge the gap between North Yemenis and South Yemenis to actually create a common Yemeni identity?
That's a good question. So both North and South Yemen, both the socialist state in the South and the state in the North claimed Yemen, and Yemenis always saw themselves as a single nation, some exceptions, but basically there's a strong sense of everybody being Yemeni. And at the time of unification in 1990, it was extremely popular. People coming together. I was working in the South at the time, and people were really looking forward to unity. They thought of, you know, the idea of political liberalism and the economic advantages that the combination of the South and the North and the experience, the Southerners that experienced, you know, long years of British colonialism and then Soviet colonialism, in effect. Which they learned a lot from, and so they knew how to run a state, and they had state-building capabilities, and they could help the North that didn't have those, but had a lot more people and other resources, and that it would be a great opportunity. That opportunity soured quickly, and it deteriorated to the war in 1994, in which, in effect, the North liquidated the South. And at that point, Southerners took a different view of what was happening, because basically Ali Dollah Saleh's rule regime came down, and they were like carpetbaggers. And they saw the Southerners, regardless of who they were and their politics, as others and opportunities to exploit. And that unified the South. And so the North-South split on the level of people. And then the origins of what we see today of the movement for secession, of recreation of the Thursday, that's a result of the experience of the war and what happened after the war in 1994. So it's not something that's fundamental to identity or it's just the treatment that happened there. But what we should say is that the South is very divided about that. Hadi is a Southerner. Hadi comes from Abyad, and those that are around him, they're all Southerners. Hadi was a socialist. He was a socialist military guy. So the STC, the Southern Transitional Council, the one that runs Aden right now, and that's got Emirati backing, that's sort of the core of a faction within that was in the Southern state, in the socialist state. And even within that region of Lahij and Aden and Dalia, there's people who do not support the STC. There's actually a lot of people that don't support the STC. The question of what to do with that, and the guys out in Hadamount, the far eastern part, which is not far from Marib, they don't want anything to do with the western part, with the Adenese and whatnot. So, there's not consensus on a southern succession or something like that. There is consensus that that the South has been exploited by the North. That there is consensus on, but not on what to do for a future state. Of course, the Houthis now have been seen as Northerners. For the South, they just see the Houthis as another version of a Northern invasion trying to go after them. And so they can unite around anti-Houthiism. They can unite around keeping the Houthi out. But beyond that, there's a lot of work to be done.
So Khalid Saleh, I guess one of the enduring questions for me is, since, as we've stated before, there's not really all that many oil reserves in Yemen. Yemen's a poor country. It was, prior to the conflict, it was one of the poorest countries, and since the conflict, is one of the two or three poorest countries in the world. Why is there so much international interest in this conflict? What are the Saudis, the Iranians, and then ultimately the Americans? What's drawing them to this conflict?
There is the geography, which places the country, the port of Aden, for example, as a strategic, from a geostrategic perspective. That location is very significant. But there is also the other variable, that Yemen became a center for regional competition or proxy wars. It gives the Saudis, who are worried, and the Yemenis, who are worried by their borders, their countries, national interests, but also it gives some strategic depth to the Iranian by supporting a movement that has serious problems with Yemen, the support of external forces, namely Saudi Arabia in this case. And it has worked for the Iranian. We've seen this in Lebanon. We've seen it in Syria. And if we put it in perspective, it was the doctrine, George W. Bush, a preemptive doctrine in which, we invaded Iraq for the purpose of regime change. And we had a choice either to go to Syria to change it or Iran. That was the prevailing view at the time strategically. So the Iranian had concerns from that perspective. So it provided a ground for this kind for strategic depth for regional powers. And I think those are the two variables that one consider when we think of Yemen. The other thing is, this is a very rich country in culture. It has a lot of meaning for the Muslims. So it also has that value as well. And when you look at the countries that are affected from the Arab perspective, these are the countries that have a long history and a rich culture in the minds of the Arab world. So it also fits into that notion of yet another civilization attack or Western attack, imperial attack against a country that is one of the roots of the Islamic traditions and the Arab culture.
And Charles Schmitz, I know the U.S. has been interested in Yemen really since even the days before 9/11 because of the attack on the USS Cole in the port of Aden, and that the U.S. has been operating militarily, largely under the auspices, you know, the fight in the global war on terror, and has actually stated this when the Pentagon was asked under the AUMF, the Authorization of the Use of Military Force resolution, Congress asked who is the U.S. at war with, and the U.S. cited Yemen. Is the U.S.'s major interest in Yemen fighting global terrorism, or are there other major interests at play for the Americans?
It was terrorism. So the United States for the longest time sort of took the lead from Saudi Arabia. Really, a lot of this conflict is that the Saudis fear Yemen. They've got a long border, and there are more Yemeni nationals than there are nationals of all the Gulf states combined, including Saudi Arabia. So they see all kinds of threats from Yemen, and the Saudis want to be the most influential foreign power in Yemen. They see their security in being the most influential foreign power in Yemen. And that's why they're so upset with the Houthis, because the Houthis won't deal. And furthermore, they're friends with Iran. So, I mean, that's just the nightmare. That's just the worst nightmare possible for the Saudis. The Americans, Yemen's a very complex place. And it takes, you know, a lot of astute observation and time and experience. And the Americans didn't, they just let the Saudis tell them what to do until about unification, I think. And that was where, you know, Saudi and U.S. interests diverged, because the Saudis backed the Southerners trying to extract revenge against the Ahmad al-Salih, who had backed Saddam Hussein. And at that point, the United States was against the war. The United States wanted, fighting not to happen. And at that point, the United States was interested in stability. It's both stability, because the United States is the power, is the regional power, and doesn't want revolutions and upheavals and all this. And it's connected with terrorism as well. And yes, the United States, under Obama, in fact, it was Obama that really expanded the drone campaign against al-Qaeda in Yemen. And it was under the AMUF of 9/11. It was seen as, you know, still fighting al-Qaeda. It wasn't seen as fighting Yemen. And in fact, what's interesting about this, we'll bring it circle around. Hussein al-Houthi, who's the founder of the Houthi movement, he was very much against, he admired Iran, but he admired Iran in its geopolitical stance. In other words, he saw, you know, a principled stance against U.S. Israeli hegemony in the Middle East. That was his main stance. And he saw the Yemeni regime as sort of subservient to the Americans. And it was in particular with the war on terror. But then secondly, the lead up to the war in Iraq, and which Hussein al-Houthi interpreted as, you know, just in another imperial war of the Americans to maintain their hegemony in the region. He played that very astutely in Yemen. And that's the origins of the Houthi movement. He upset Ali Abdullah so much that Ali Abdullah sent the military against him. And eventually the Houthi won. The Houthi, you know, they fought long, long insurgent wars against the Yemeni military that had their origins in precisely this issue of the U.S. involvement in Yemen.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Yemeni war with Charles Schmitz of Towson University and Hamoud Salih of California State University, Dominguez Hills. And I know that the previous administration, Hamoud Salih, had really emphasized the need for the U.S. to ally themselves with the Saudis for a whole host of reasons, but I think most notably was the Trump administration's opposition to Iran, that they saw that Saudi Arabia as the most likely partner to help to contain Iranian power. And Yemen seems to be really the battleground for a lot of this question of containment. How much do you expect that sort of unwavering support of the Saudis to continue now that we have a new administration?
It's hard to say. On the one hand, I believe the first statement that this administration made was to recognize the humanitarian crisis in Yemen and to push for a diplomatic political solution, typical of what President Joe Biden has been saying, through engagement of international community, and in this case, perhaps the GCC, along the line of the Gulf initiatives for Yemen. At the same time, the president made sure to acknowledge the interest or the right of the Saudis to have weapons for self-defense. And he stopped there from clarifying what those weapons were. He also removed the Houthis from the list of terrorist groups or individuals, and thus opening the door for certain kind of dialogue. I think what's happened in Yemen and probably in Syria, and I could take it further in Libya, and the role in the United States playing this will be linked to Iran's nuclear deal and the vision of this administration of how it wants to see and how bad it wants that deal. If Biden is set to do all he can, as we have seen here, what's happening in Yemen is an indication or could be easily related to how they perceive the negotiation with Iran and where they go. So far, we've seen mixed signals. And in that perspective, I think it's good to emphasize the humanitarian issue, which the Houthis said, we want to separate that. That's a real cause. I think that should be taken away from presenting a solution for Yemen. It's good to do that. It's good to push for the political solution. And I think the direction is going in that area, despite the complication at this point. But I don't see this administration engaged fully in resolving this conflict without looking at how Iran will react. So resolution to it will be based on that. The support for the Saudis is very clear. Former President Donald Trump was very clear in his interest that the Saudis presented a good business deal and he would not sacrifice it. That's his words. Joe Biden emphasis of democracy, human rights, cooperative relation, engaging international law. When you look at the implementation of it, you really don't see that. There is so much there embedded in what President Donald Trump has taken, except for the fact that President Joe Biden is now reaching more to Iran than President Donald Trump. But that also poses a question, a serious question. What kind of relationship that this administration will want with the Saudis? Because the Saudis, the United Arab Emirates in particular, don't want to rapproach more with the Iranian because they see that as an enemy. And then the whole idea of what is appear most likely is that this alliance between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, and the engagement of the Arab normalization, all these factors at play that will have a significant impact on how the United States is willing or is going to resolve and how much it wants to deal with the Iranians.
And Hamad Saleh referenced this humanitarian crisis. Just to put this in perspective, according to UNICEF, currently 24 million people are considered at risk, about 80% of Yemen's population at a humanitarian risk, including more than 12 million children. It's been described as the greatest humanitarian disaster, certainly the largest humanitarian disaster. And then on top of that, of course, has been the COVID-19 pandemic, which has done nothing but just exacerbated these challenges, making conditions all the worse in Yemen. So Charles Schmitz, how much is the Biden administration compelled to act based on these humanitarian grounds? And then add to that the other complication under the Trump administration, which is the relationship with Saudi Arabia came under fire because of Saudi action, specifically the assassination of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, which had Congress starting to raise questions as to whether the U.S.'s unwavering support for the Saudis, in particular in the war in Yemen, was warranted. So do you expect there's going to be a change as a result of this new presidency?
I'm with Hamoud in the sense that, look, the U.S.-Saudi relationship is a very old one. It goes back to, by legend, a meeting on a ship, but Roosevelt and King Abdulaziz at the end of World War II. But the U.S. in the Middle East still, its major ally is the Saudis and the Gulf states. You know, that's the GCC was created in 1981 after the revolution in Iran, and that's where the U.S. positioned itself. And basically, the U.S. is still there. Trump basically gave the Saudis a blank check to do anything they wanted. I mean, he wasn't really paying attention. Here, Biden and Congress, they want more accountability, but, you know, nobody has sort of said, well, you know, this is a strategic ally, and what, you know, what kind of a relationship are we going to have here, given the realities? And most of them don't know a whole lot about the realities, I think, frankly, of the region. So I don't expect a lot. On the humanitarian front, look, Yemen in the modern era, since the founding of the republics in the 60s, it had two sort of economic booms. The first one was remittances. As the OPEC price hike happened and you know, the Gulf states had a construction booms, it was Yemen that sort of, Yemeni labor that built it all. And then as that economy changed and Yemenis came home, Yemen got its own oil, and Yemen had kind of its own oil boom. And the oil boom, you know, sort of kept Yemen afloat through the 2000s and even in, you know, up until recently. The oil was running out. Peak oil in Yemen was like 2001, and it's been going down and down ever since. And there's probably not a whole lot more. Of course, the war and instability has prevented any kind of new exploration, but you know, there's not a whole lot more there. And so Yemen was facing, just as the war broke out, Yemen was facing a severe economic crisis. Anyway, Hamoud referenced the oil, the fuel subsidies, and that was an issue, and the government was going broke. And it was time for the country to pull together and face a very difficult transition to a non-oil economy. And instead of doing that, the country broke down and had political fights and went to war. And so part of the humanitarian crisis is the fact that Yemen was facing a tough economic transition to a post-hydrocarbon economy and basically didn't do it, and instead went to war. And during the war, of course, infrastructure has been destroyed. I mean, that's the real criticism of the Saudis, is kind of like, you know, their war effort didn't work in the initial period, and they seem to take revenge by just blowing everything they possibly could up. And so, you know, medical facilities and bridges and communications and all these sorts of things that have exacerbated the humanitarian situation. So they've lost the income. A big portion, actually, of the GDP was government salaries, and that's all gone because the oil is gone. And Yemen had been importing a large percentage of its food. That has shifted since the war. Farmers have sort of shifted some of their production, but people's income, people don't have income, and it's become a war economy. So the Houthi live off of kind of a severe taxation, and they control the oil in the north, and so they control some of the markets in the north. They've been sort of scraping by with that. The Emirates are paying salaries for their people, and the Saudis are paying salaries for the other, and so it's sort of a warlord economy. That's basically what we have, a warlord economy. And the way you survive is becoming a soldier. If you've got a soldier, you get if somebody in the family is fighting, they get some pay. That helps them to get through. And, you know, if you're not, then you're in tough straits. And so the humanitarian situation, all the things you mentioned, there's been cholera outbreaks of medical stuff, the coronavirus as well has hit, and it's actually hitting right now. One of the Houthi former chiefs of staff apparently just died of coronavirus. There's a wave that's hitting right now. All these things are on top of a fundamental crisis that was happening even before the war broke out. So yes, and the international community has been giving. So we've got an economy that at the beginning of the war was about 30 billion. Right now it's estimated to be about half that, about $15 billion. And aid has been, you know, 3 billion, 4 billion. And that 3 or 4 billion, in addition to remittances that folks are sending in from outside of Yemen, the family members and whatnot, that's what's keeping Yemen alive right now. And they depend on it. So there's got to be humanitarian relief, and countries have got to step up and keep it going, or it's going to be really serious.
So this is my last question I'm going to ask both of you. I'll start with Hamoud with this. We painted a picture of just humanitarian disaster and suffering in Yemen and this complicated conflict. The last question is, How do we see a pathway to peace? I know that one of the challenges has been that the United Nations has a framework for peace. In essence, the Houthis must surrender power, and then they can negotiate their way into some sort of a coalition within a post-conflict government. Of course, the Houthis control the capital city, so it's unreasonable to think that they're going to surrender the city in order to try to negotiate their way back into that. So I guess it's kind of two questions. What are the role of the Houthis in these negotiations? And does this framework need to change? And if it does, how could you suggest that we could change these conditions or change the peace framework to match the conditions on the ground? We might eventually come to some sort of a resolution in this conflict.
I think the attitude must change of both parties, that they view the conflict as not sort of, and it's hard to say this, a zero-sum game, but rather a win-win solution for all. Now, the Houthis were blamed, or some blame them, for not giving a political solution a chance back in 2015, when the army collapsed, when the Yemeni collapsed, and the whole violence began. At the time, they objected at the plan, which made them truly representative in the transition government or in the plan for the future Yemen, specifically, that they were not seen as a major power. What happened since then is that the Houthis proved to be a very important power. They have the military leverage, but the Houthis, at one point or another, must come back to the negotiation table and began, I hate to say serious negotiation, but began working in a national dialogue. That national dialogue, when it started, they were part of it. For 9 months, they were negotiating. Over 500 people participated. It presented a core for raising national issues. And the main issue at this point, from my perspective, that need to be addressed is the division of power. We have to sort of take into account that cabinet ministries, that power has to be shared, and where the Houthis could benefit from that. In one of the transition government, we had, I think, about 34 ministers. The two parties did not even allow them to have two. So the problem of the Houthi is very, very important. In other words, you have to create a system where it is representative of all the major political actors. The United Nations Security Council talks about the youth, the women, and the separatists in the south. Connected to that is really the most important thing, is an economic plan where we have to find a solution to ease the burden, this humanitarian burden on the Yemenis. And of course, on the top of that is, we've seen this in Libya, the emphasis on ceasefire, no intervention in the case of Libya of foreign countries or mercenaries. I think the United Nations Security Council, and maybe this is just asking for the moon, must really be serious about the militarization of this conflict, the introduction of drones, making the war very easy to hit places and so on and so forth. And it's on both sides. And what's happening today with attacking Saudi facilities and so on and so forth is clear indication that the root of the problems must be addressed. And one of them is how to address the militarization of this conflict and in ways that would contribute to the recovery of the economy, the political solution, and the inclusion of all parties, including the Houthis, and more so in the, and not just in the dialogue, but the actual implementation of the institutions that serve them, and including perhaps how to make this federation or a Yemeni united and the federal system that is representative of the Yemeni. The Arabs will tell you, get out all the foreign problems, let the Yemenis handle it, and we will be okay. But that's maybe also a long dream. I don't know. Yeah.
And Charles Schmitz, I'll give you the last word. You've written a piece called No Winners in Yemen. Is there a scenario where there could potentially be winners, or at least satisficers who are willing to lay down their weapons to end this conflict?
At the moment, I'm pessimistic.
Hamoud was referencing the UN resolution 2216, and that one clearly is not realistic at all. It's, you know, going to go by the side that the Houthi are the government in the, you know, they govern, you know, I don't know what it is, 70% of the population or something like this, and they're well entrenched. Nobody trusts each other at this point. The Houthi are not real trustable, you know, for the people outside, and I don't see a political solution. The only thing that let me preface that by saying, you know, I do see the Houthi and the Saudis being able to work it out. The Houthis and the Saudis could work it out. You know, basically the Saudis want the attacks to stop, and the Houthis have the capability of doing that. The Houthis have control, and they can stop. The Houthi want the ports opened. Right now there's a UN inspection regime that's inspecting for weapons to keep weapons from arriving. And so it doesn't work, but there is that there, and the Houthi want that released, which of course would allow the Houthi to get more arms. But I think the Saudis and the Houthi could come to agreement. The problem is the Houthi and the rest of Yemen can't come to an agreement. And just the political distance is just too far. The only thing, and this is my shoot for the moon, came from what Hamoud was saying, is that the one big thing that everybody would get everybody's attention is the economy. Because the economic situation is really desperate. And that's part of the fight for Marib right now. That's why the Houthi want the gas and oil revenues. If there was economic hope. But the thing about it is that would require so much sort of outside support and smart, well-designed outside support. I'm not sure that the international community is capable of that. But that would be a game changer. That would get everyone's attention, and that would facilitate other things. So generally, I'm pessimistic. But if I want to shoot for the moon, you know, something along economic deals for me would bring people together.
Sadly, being pessimistic and specializing in Yemen seemed to be a connection that makes far too much sense. We've been discussing the ongoing war in Yemen, the humanitarian disaster, the role of international actors, and whether the U.S. might shift its policies with a new administration. Our guests have been Hamoud Salih, the Associate Dean of International Education and Senior International Officer and Professor of Political Science at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He is a commentator for Arabic media. And Charles Schmitz, Professor of Geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland. He is an affiliated scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and the author of several publications, including Negotiating Yemeni Peace, Deep Divisions and Hard Realities, No Winners in Yemen, and the Historical Dictionary of Yemen. Thank you both very much.
Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We know the role of presidents and other leaders in shaping history, but we hear little about the unsung heroes, many who have risked their lives to liberate and rescue others. Who might some of those secret heroes be? We're joined by Paul Martin, journalist, editor, and author of Secret Heroes, Everyday Americans Who Shaped Our World. Welcome, Paul Martin. Often thousands are forgotten for the good they've done in making societies better, and you pulled a few out and wrote about them in your book.
That's right. I've always had a lifelong fascination with unsung heroes. I've kept a file for years on these characters when I come across them in my reading or see something on television. When I decided to do a book, I tried to pull out 30 of the most interesting, offering a really broad range of time periods and backgrounds, occupations, and so forth. And the mix that I have is just filled with people that ought to be better known. I mean, there's Hercules Mulligan, who is a tailor in New York City during the Revolutionary War, and he was recruited as a spy. And on two occasions, since he had British officers as customers, he learned about plots to waylay General Washington and was able to warn him and very possibly save his life.
Wasn't his brother also involved?
Was also involved. In fact, his brother was a conduit for another outstanding thing that Mulligan did, and that is he literally converted Alexander Hamilton to the American cause. Hamilton was born in the Caribbean, and he had grown up. He was a loyal British subject, and when he came to study in New York. He went to King's College, which is today's Columbia University, and he needed a place to stay, and he contacted Hercules Mulligan's brother, who referred him on to Hercules, and Alexander Hamilton stayed with Mulligan, and through the course of evening's conversations with Mulligan and his friends, Hamilton was won over to the American cause and became, you know, a real leader.
One of the characters that I thought was most interesting and that I hadn't known as much about as I would have liked to was Mary Elizabeth Bowser, who played a huge role in the Civil War. Tell us about her and her impact on the Civil War.
She was born a slave in Richmond, Virginia. Her master was a hardware merchant in Richmond, and he actually sold off Bowser's family, her mother and father and brother and sister. His name was John Van Loo, and when he died, his daughter, Elizabeth Van Loo, bought back Bowser's family and gave them all their freedom. And Elizabeth Van Loo sent Mary Bowser to Philadelphia to be educated. Bowser came back to Richmond just as the Civil War was starting, and when the Civil War began, Elizabeth Van Loo formed a spy ring for the Union. She recruited Mary Bowser because she was a rarity. She was a former slave, an African-American who was educated, could read and write, which was obviously a rarity at that time. And Van Loo was able to place her in the White House of the Confederacy, the home of Jefferson Davis and his wife and children. Bowser was a family servant, and she took care of Jefferson Davis's children and served meals, cleaned up afterwards. Well, as far as Davis knew, she was an illiterate slave, and he and his officers spoke openly in front of her. She also had a photographic memory, and Davis would leave his papers strewn around on his desk, and she could just, at a glance, pick up all sorts of information about Southern troop movements and finances and so forth. She relayed those on to the Union. She was recognized in 1995 as one of the most important spies for the Union cause during the Civil War.
How was she able to convey that information?
There were some fascinating ways. They would hide messages in like a basket full of eggs. They would hollow out one of the eggs and put messages inside the egg. And another way was they would put it in the shoes of a slave, and the Southerners were disdainful and wouldn't, you know, want to have anything to do with the slaves and their clothing, and so they were able to get things past the Southern soldiers. So it was an amazing display of bravery for 2 years to be by herself, right, as I said, in the lion's den. It turned out that she discovered so many secrets that they began to suspect that there was a mole somewhere in the White House of the Confederacy, and so she fled. She was there for 2 years, and her last act was she tried to burn down the White House of the Confederacy. She wasn't successful, but she fled in 1864 and was never heard of again. She disappeared from history.
There were three other women that I thought were particularly interesting in your book. Anne Royal was one, Grace Abbott, and Inez Boisevain.
Yes, all three of those I'd never heard of. And in fact, I could say I think all but one or two of the characters in my book I'd never heard of, and I wasn't familiar with even the ones that I had heard of. For instance, Hedy Lamarr, I didn't know that the achievements she did that were totally unknown to the public. But the three persons that you mentioned, Anne Royal was just this fabulous character. She was born on the frontier and survived Indian attacks, and she ended up marrying an older man who was quite wealthy. And when he died, she traveled around a bit, and she was well-to-do, but then her husband's family overturned the will, and she was left absolutely penniless at the age of 54. So she decided she'd become a writer, and she started writing travel books, and she wrote one novel. She lived hand-to-mouth the whole time. And then she went to Washington, D.C., and when she was in her 60s, she began a newspaper, and she was a terror. She was the first muckraker in American journalism, and she would traipse around the halls of Congress and government offices and just buttonhole officials and grill them. She would print everything, you know, she found, and she had very strong opinions. She was adamantly for the separation of church and state, and she was just a holy terror.
I think you mentioned that people still study her in journalism schools.
They do. She's regarded as the first of the muckrakers. She's really the first investigative journalist in early history of journalism. Journalism often was advertising or PR almost, and she really dug for the truth and was fearless. And she made so many enemies that the U.S. Post Office stopped delivering her newspaper because she made so many enemies on Capitol Hill. So she started a second newspaper and delivered it on her own. And of course, she never had a very wide circulation or never made any money. In fact, she died. I think she had a total of 6 cents when she died, but her influence was tremendous.
And then the other two really interesting women, Grace Abbott and Inez Boisevain, had to have a little bit more of a similar impact.
Grace Abbott is just someone that you'd never hear of, and the woman was absolutely amazing. She grew up in Nebraska and was trained as a teacher, and she went to Chicago and studied at the University of Chicago, and then she became involved in protecting immigrants. And for 9 years, she ran the Immigrant Protective League, and then she was recruited to the U.S. Children's Bureau, which at that time was a federal office to overlook the rights of the interests of children. And she improved the lives of millions of people through information she distributed on maternal health care and infant health care. Even then, and still today, the infant mortality rate in this country is really shocking. We have 4 times the infant mortality rate of Japan today. And she did so much to protect the children. The other thing she did was she was instrumental in writing the child labor provisions of the Social Security Act. And she also wrote child labor provisions in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was passed in 1938. Unbelievably, there was still exploitative child labor up to 1938. But afterwards, when that law was passed, we finally ended that shameful period of our history. The other person you mentioned, Inez Boisevain, she was a colorful character. She was one of the few characters in the book who grew up in a wealthy family. And she had a privileged upbringing. She went to Vassar College, but she was a real rebel, and she was in the forefront of the women's suffrage movement, and she made speeches on campus, and as I said in the book, I think the people at Vassar probably threw themselves a party when she finally graduated. But she went on to New York, and she got a law degree at New York University, and one of the first things she did was investigate the horrible prison conditions at Sing Sing, and she wrote a report, and it resulted in widespread reforms. And she literally gave her life for the cause. She was speaking in the western half of the United States, trying to get passage of universal women's suffrage, and she collapsed on stage in Los Angeles, and it turned out she had pernicious anemia, which today is very treatable, but back then it wasn't, and she ended up dying, and so she was a martyr to her cause.
Yeah, only 30 years old.
Exactly, and they told her if she cut back and, you know, stopped exerting herself, she could probably weather this health issue, but she refused to. She literally gave her life for the cause.
And then if we were to move up in time, there are two other people. They're very different. One was Golden Rule Jones, who was very interesting, and the other was Kirk Bloodsworth.
Golden Rule Jones, of course, was a progressive leader during the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century. He grew up poor, and he got into the oil business, and he started his own company and made a fortune. He moved to Ohio and started Ohio Oil, which was bought out by Standard Oil, and so he became quite wealthy. But he had a tragedy in his life. His wife and one of his children passed away. He remarried, and his second wife lived in Toledo. So he moved to Toledo, and he started a company to produce oil drilling equipment. It had the memorable name of the Acme Sucker Rod Company. And he was 50 years ahead of his time. He instituted an 8-hour workday. He refused to use child labor. I mean, this was all before, while these things were going on, he was doing these things on his own. He gave Christmas bonuses, paid vacations. He built a park and playground for his employees. And his whole point of view was that everyone should live by the golden rule. I mean, it was very simple, and that's the way he treated his employees, and they responded with incredible loyalty. Well, he became famous for this, and they started around Toledo, started calling him Golden Rule Jones, and then he was put up for election by the Republicans and for mayor of Toledo, and he won. And the amazing thing was that when he started introducing the same kinds of reforms that he'd done in his company to city government, the Republicans were up in arms, business interests. They thought, you know, that this was not the way to go. So the next election for mayor, they kicked him to the side, and he ran as an independent, and he won with 70% of the vote, and he was reelected three other times. He died in office when he was 54, but he was a real progressive, and he was one of the people who brought us things that we accept today. Everyone thinks that a 40-hour work week and paid vacations are the right of all Americans, but if it wasn't for people like Samuel Jones, that just wouldn't have happened. The other person you mentioned, Kirk Bloodsworth, he's interesting for several reasons. One, he's the only living character of the 30 people I write about. He's still alive. He grew up on the eastern shore of Maryland. His family was, they were watermen. He grew up crabbing and oystering, helping his dad on his boat. And he joined the Marines, and after the Marines, he married a woman who lived in Essex, Maryland, which is a suburb of Baltimore. And at the very time that he settled in Essex, a 9-year-old girl was brutally raped and murdered, and Kirk Bloodsworth was arrested for this. He had nothing to do with it. He was completely innocent. And he was convicted basically on the testimony of a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old who said they saw him. Well, he spent 9 years in prison. He was convicted and given the death sentence, and he was sent to prison in Baltimore, the state prison penitentiary. His death sentence was overturned. He was given 2 life terms. And to while away the time, I mean, to keep himself sane, he would read a lot in the prison library, and he happened to read a book about DNA profiling, which was perfected in 1984 by a professor in Leicester, England, and a light bulb went on, and Bloodsworth said, well, this could be used to prove I was not the killer. And it just happened that his attorney had asked that all the evidence in the case be saved, and it was sent to a lab in California and tested, and he was exonerated and set free after 9 years in prison. He was the first death row inmate to be set free by DNA testing in this country.
And then he went on and made it part of his cause.
He did. He was instrumental in getting the Innocence Protection Act and the testing portion of that act, which any convicted prisoner is tested for DNA now. Their DNA is recorded, and that test is named in Bloodsworth's honor.
Well, Paul Martin, thank you so much, and thank you for honoring the everyday Americans who shape our world. The book, again, is called Secret Heroes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.